Okay, I want to start tonight at July 28th, 1902. You're on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. It's a lot warmer than it is in this room right now. It's a sweltering hot day. And there are 100,000 people crammed into just a few blocks radius as they're escorting the casket of the very first chief rabbi of New York to his final resting place. And as they pass by a company by the name of R.H. Ho and Company, apparently that was a company, I have a picture, but you can't see it, you will notice that the workers at the company started throwing metal and bricks and materials on those who were there to mourn that day. A riot ensued, and over 200 people were injured and had to be taken to the hospital. And all of the 100,000 gathered there that day were to commemorate and to memorialize one individual, the person we are going to speak about tonight, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, Rabbi Jacob Joseph, New York's first chief rabbi. And what I want to talk about tonight is why that scene of a riot breaking out on the Lower East Side of Manhattan is the perfect scene to capture a very tragic life of an individual who at one point had enormous untold potential. Part of what we're going to discuss tonight is not just about Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, but about the notion and the institution of a chief rabbi in general. Was America ever going to be hospitable for a chief rabbi? Was it hospitable at the end of the 19th century, during the 19th century, 20th century? Would America ever be hospitable to the notion of a chief rabbi? Could an imported European rabbi ever succeed on the modern shores of America, where so many individuals were here for one purpose and one purpose only, and it was to check their European culture at the door and to Americanize themselves? And lastly, could different types of Jews unite around one model of a chief rabbi? Could European Jews and Hungarian Jews and Galician Jews, could they all unite around one type of a chief rabbi? Those are the topics we are going to speak about this evening. We begin with the model of a chief rabbi. You have the what? All right, you'll set it up while I'm talking. We begin with the model of a chief rabbi, and that is to look no different than our friends across the pond, and that is in Great Britain. Rabbi Dr. Nathan Marcus Adler was the chief rabbi of the British Empire from 1845 to 1890. And many people felt that if Great Britain could have a chief rabbi, then so can America. I'll share with you two quotes of individuals who felt this way. Number one is Rabbi Isaac Leitzer. Have we spoken about him? Is he on the list? If he's not, he should be. He will be next year. Rabbi Isaac Leitzer was quoted as saying the following. In 1845, he editorialized the following. Oh, please, Hashem. He had a see? Thank you. He editorialized the following. Moreover, if Dr. Adler can show by his acts the usefulness of a spiritual chief, it will not be long before the American Israelites will also demand the election of a chief with several associates to provide over our worship and our education. We indeed candidly think that we require in this country some ecclesiastical authority and above the independent ministers. In other words, if it worked in Great Britain, why can't it work here? The Reverend Abraham Rice of Baltimore, who you should know a lot about after last week, wrote the following in a publication called The Occident. He says, however, I think that it is my duty to call your attention to a subject on which I have kept silent hitherto, from the sole motive that someone might believe me speaking from interested motives. In other words, they might think he's talking about himself. It is to urge upon the Jews of the United States the great importance of selecting a spiritual chief. And so there were those who felt that in America, with a multitude of spiritual dangers, the antidote to all of that, this issue that would solve all of their problems, would be to bring in a chief rabbi. And so a first attempt was made to bring in the chief rabbi, and that was none other than the Malbim. Now, many of you might be surprised to see that name, because if you learn, for example, Tehillim or any other book of Tanakh, you'll notice that the Malbim is on the bottom as a parish, as a commentary on Tanakh. But you will be surprised to find out that the Malbim was the first choice to be New York's chief rabbi. Malbim Remeir Leibush Ben Yechiel Michel was born in Bologna, orphaned at the age of 6, served as the rabbi in, I don't know how to pronounce that, Reshin, and in 1859 became the chief rabbi of Bucharest, Romania. Was he a good choice, or was he not a good choice? Therein lies the question. Well, 26 communities pledged an annual amount of $2,800, which was a significant amount of money. But the question was the Malbim, who we revere as one of the great biblical commentaries, was he the right choice? And many people were very reticent about his choice. Number one, he was 70 years old. He was a little old to take on the position that required such vigor and such ambition and such vision. I'm just joking. 70 is the new 40. Don't worry, right? But there were many who were nervous about, at the age of 70, taking on such a daunting task, which was the first chief rabbi of New York. The other major knock on him was, where was he coming from? He was coming from Europe. And again, as I alluded to in my introduction, could a European rabbi successfully come to America, acclimate himself, and most importantly, could he speak a language that the people would understand? The Jewish Record of Philadelphia recorded the following. Reverend Dr. Malbim is over 70 years of age, and it appears to us that no matter how learned or distinguished a rabbi he may be, it would be folly to select a man of his age, ignorant of the language and customs of this country, to fill so responsible a position. Surely some learned English-speaking rabbi in his prime of life might be secured if the matter was settled upon you. In other words, the Malbim is great. He's a big Talmud Chacham. We're sure he's an amazing individual. But like anything in life, it's a shidduch. A husband and a wife, he could be a great guy and she could be a great girl. Doesn't mean they're meant to be married to each other. A rabbi and a shul are no different. And so they say it's very nice that the Malbim is some great rabbi, very high esteemed, a big Talmud Chacham. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's a good fit for the demands and the rigors of the job that we are looking for. Other opposition, which will not surprise you, was from Isaac Meir Weiss, the leader of the Reform movement, who writes the following. As a man of rabbinical learning, he, talking about the Malbim, is highly respectable, but he appears not to have the slightest idea of the wants and demands of this age. He would be played out in New York 4 weeks after his arrival because he could not do anything very useful and startling for his congregations. In other words, you're wasting your time. One of the questions when we interview someone, especially when we're hiring them from out of city or out of state, because when you call someone for a reference, always they're going to give you glowing references. So we ask the person who likely cares about the person that they're referencing, otherwise they wouldn't have been put down as a reference. We say to them, well, we're going to ask that person to move. Let's say they're moving from Texas. We're going to move someone, their family, from Texas. And if it doesn't work out, we're going to let them go very quickly, and they're going to be left in Florida with no safety net, with no networking, nothing. Do you still recommend them for the position? And all of a sudden, everyone says, well, maybe, I don't know, maybe, right? So that's exactly what he's saying here. In other words, it's very nice the Malbim is coming, and I'm sure he's a great rabbi, but that doesn't mean that he's going to be a good fit. And here you'll have spent an enormous sum of money, you'll brought someone across the ocean, and they're not really going to succeed. Rav Yaakov Halevi Lipschitz of Kovna writes the following. Oh, I'm going to get to that in a second. Okay. What was America at that time? What did it look like at that time? So between 1881 and 1885, there were 50,000 Jews that immigrated to the United States from Eastern European countries. Very important. many rabbis were deeply concerned about the spiritual state of America. Now, that concern didn't just exist in the quote from 1887 that I'm about to read to you, but it remained long into the 20th century. Right? When we talk about great rabbis coming over from Europe to America, one of the reasons they didn't leave earlier from Europe than they should have was because they were nervous. America was a spiritual wasteland. And what would happen when you came to America? So here's a quote from Yaakov Halevi Lipschitz, writes from Kovna in 1887. He says, "For some years now, many leading rabbis who are greatly concerned with the welfare of their people and the Torah have turned their attention to their brethren in America." In other words, if you care about Jews around the world, you're going to pay attention to the Jews in America. "Since the material and spiritual lives of American Israel are so intertwined with their brethren here, in matters of aid and support, in matters of family purity, marriage, divorce, which are officiated over by improper men, in matters of kashrus, to deal with these problems, the leading rabbis held three conferences in 1885, in Telz and in Punovich, to seek ways and means of elevating Jewish religious life in America." In other words, long before the globalization of the economy, in the global markets, where what happens in America is going to influence the markets in Japan and vice versa, rabbis recognize that as Judaism went in one part of the world, Judaism went in other parts of the world. And if there were rabbis in America that were performing marriages or divorces in an inauthentically halachic way, well, that was going to have reverberations that was maybe not in the short term, but in the long term, was going to deeply impact Jews around the world. And so European rabbis, the top European rabbis, get together and they worry about American Jewry. So what happens? In 1887, the New York City had a population of about 100 to 100,000, 120,000 families. There were 130 shuls and only three or four rabbis. Not a very significant ratio, but it tells you a lot about the makeup of American Jewry, certainly in New York at the time, and about why there was such a craving and a desire for a chief rabbi, someone who could come in and inspire the masses, who could officiate it over what was essentially at that time religious anarchy. And we'll see examples of that in a second. There were enormous challenges that American Jewry faced at that moment. Number one, kashrus. Some things don't change very easily, and that is kashrus. Kashrus at that time was a business. It was chaotic. It was disorganized, and it was unsupervised. Ish beyashar beinav yaseh. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. It was an enormous industry, and when you put money together with kashrus, bad things oftentimes happen. Okay, and we'll see a greater manifestation of that as the night goes on. Shochtim, shchita, was a law unto themselves. We take for granted nowadays that you can go to the grove, you can go to a Roma, and there's a symbol, an OU, whatever, and you know that it's kosher. And you know that there's a national standard that you're abiding by, that you could put your full faith in, that this product is okay. It wasn't like that in the 19th century, the mid to the end of the 19th century. It was chaos. It was anarchy. People were selling meat, and you had really no idea whether it was kosher or not. And they could price gouge for heksher, because you were fully dependent on individuals. You didn't have the systems in place, the shipping mechanisms in place that we have nowadays. And lastly, the cheder system was largely unsuccessful, and again, also in disarray. All of this serves as the backdrop for the continuation of a search to find a chief rabbi of New York, someone who would essentially serve as a savior. And so in 1887, many congregations get together and they each pledge $2,500. I'll just give you a sense of what, $2,500 was pledged in total. And I'll give you a sense of some of the names of the congregations that pledged money. The Beis HaMedrash HaGadol, which we'll come back to, would pledge $500. Any familiar with people? No? Okay. Kahal Adas Yishurin, $300. Mishkan Yisrael Anche, $250. Chevra Kadisha, $250. Mikra Kodesh, $100. B'nai MS Anshe Mirimpol, $75. Shari Torah, $50. Shari Bina, $25. Ava Shalom, $30. All of this, together with a few private individuals, put together $2,500. And they decided that how are you going to go about the best rabbinic search process? What is that going to look like? Where do you look? Well, in America, were there the stature of the rabbis that they were looking for? The answer is no. And so they reached out to their brothers in Europe, namely the great Rabbanim of Europe, and they asked them for their advice of who they can recommend. Some of the names that they reached out to. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spechter of Kovna, right? Again, who Reitz at YU is named after. Rabbi Hillel Lipschitz, Rabbi Eliyahu Meisels, Rabbi Azriel Hilsheimer, of the famous Hilsheimer Yeshiva, and Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Vilna. Many people, here's the letter that they sent. Let me read you a quote of why he should come. Skip the page here. Okay. Of why he should come. We unanimously decided, this is the text of the letter that was sent to the European rabbis. We unanimously decided to invite, as our spiritual leader, a rabbi noted for scholarship and for piety. Right? Notice those two words. What were they looking for? Scholarship and piety. His mission would be to remove the stumbling blocks before our people and to unite the hearts of our brethren. In other words, to elevate the level of religion in America and to unite the Jewish people, to serve God with one heart and soul, to supervise with an open eye the Shochtim, all matters of holiness of the house of Israel, which to our deep sorrow are not observed nor respected because there is no authority nor guide revered and accepted by the whole community, and each one is an authority unto himself. Now, if you received that letter, take the job or not take the job? Not take the job. Various recommendations were made from leading rabbis in Europe, but who would come? And so the first choice was a rabbi that was chosen from Europe, and that was Rabbi Yaakov Halevi Lipschitz, who I quoted to you earlier. He was the secretary to Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spechter. That sounds just a little bit shady. Why does that sound just a little bit shady? Who was one of the letters written to? Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spechter. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spechter said, well, I don't want the job, but I got a friend here who would love the job. And so, as the first choice, the name was submitted of Rabbi Yaakov Halevi Lipschitz. And yet, it was categorically rejected. Why? Why was it rejected? Well, who wanted to choose? Right? If you were the search committee of New York Jewry, would you want some archaic, outdated rabbi from Europe dictating to you? Or would you, as a congregation, want to take a vote and decide for yourselves who should be a rabbi? Imagine if YU or Lakewood or Neri Yisrael came to BRS and said, we are dictating that blank is going to be a rabbi. You would say, that's very nice, but excuse me, we know our shul just a little bit better than you. We know our community just a little bit better than you. And so it's very nice for you to make recommendations, but ultimately, we know what's best for ourselves. And so the Jews in New York were very insulted that the Jews of Europe were trying to dictate to them who the rabbi should be. And so they went down the list, one after another, after another. Would you take the job? Would you leave the religious comforts of Europe? Would you leave friends and family and cross the shores to a spiritual wasteland of America? And so one after another rabbi said no, until they came to the last rabbi standing by the name of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Vilna. Now, who was Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Vilna? He was born in 1840, died in 1902, as we're going to see. He was a communal preacher who was known for his brilliant drushas. We're actually going to read an excerpt from one of them as the night goes on. And he was also a dayan in Vilna. He was a religious judge in Vilna. He learned in the yeshiva in Volozhin, and he was known as Harif. Actually, if you look there, which you can't see because it's very small. But it says, Tmunat HaRab, in other words, the picture of Rabbi HaGaon Rav Yaakov Harif, Rav HaKolel Ben Yor. Okay, he was known as Harif. What does Harif mean? Sharp. He was known to be sharp-minded. He was also beloved. Let me read you a quote. In a letter from Michael Bayrak of Vilna to his nephew, Avram Kahan of New York, he writes the following. Don't take him. That's not what he wrote. That's what I'm saying. He is very dear to us. He is both brilliant and unusually pious. It pains us deeply that we had to bid him farewell. We did not want to lose such a precious possession. See to it that New York Jewry knows that they took from us a rare jewel. Remember that line. See to it that he is properly appreciated. Remember that line. I know that you do not go to synagogue, but you do have a Jewish heart. Therefore, won't you tell everyone that Vilna gloried in him and that New York must recognize that it now wears a precious crown. So Yaakov Yosef of Vilna was beloved, he was appreciated, and he was deeply and sorely missed when it was told that he would be leaving them. There's one problem. There's one problem. And that is that Yaakov Yosef of Vilna was heavily in debt. Heavily in debt. And so part of the deal, when he accepted the position, was I'll come to America, but on one condition. And that is I demand 5,000 rubles up front in order to be able to pay off my debtors before I come to America. Now, has anyone here ever served on a rabbinic search committee? Jeff, right? If you hire a rabbi, you send him the letter, we accept you, and he comes back and says, $10,000 signing bonus, no deal, right? How does that rub you? A little bit the wrong way, right? What else should raise a red flag about that? Why is my rabbi in such significant debt? And so they came back with a counterproposal, probably what you would have done as well. They said, okay, you're our guy, so we're not going to let you go for $5,000, 5,000 rubles, but how about this? We'll give you 2,500 now and 25 when you arrive in America. Deal or no deal? Who would take that deal? Nobody would take that deal. I know, we're all cold. We're like our bones can't move a little bit, right? Okay? Does Rav Yaakov Yosef take the deal? That was unacceptable to him. He rejected their counteroffer. Why? He was nervous that his creditors would prevent his departure from Vilna if he still owed any money. Now, many people in America started hearing about these interactions, and they started becoming very upset because they start wondering, was Rav Yaakov Yosef the man that we truly thought he was? In other words, did we hire him because of his ability, or did we hire him because of his availability? In other words, do we really want him, or was he simply the last man standing? Aspersions were cast upon his honesty and against his prudence. After all, what rabbi is negotiating, is handling us for 5,000 rubles, by the way, at that time, which was an enormous sum of money. An enormous sum of money. It was a generous offer by the Jews of New York. Much more than the average yearly salary of workmen at that time. And yet he rejected. Many people started wondering, right? Is he the guy that we think? Ultimately, they decide what you and I would decide, which is that we put all of our chips in one corner, and therefore, we're either going to sink or swim with him. And the arrangements were made to bring Rav Yaakov Yosef to the shores of the United States of America. He arrives on Shabbos, July 7th, 1888. Does not get off the boat, of course, on Shabbos, but word already spreads throughout, right? He arrives in Hoboken, and word already spreads that he has arrived, and immediately, right after Shabbos ends, people start congregating around the docks of Hoboken with enormous enthusiasm and excitement to welcome him. By all accounts that I read, at least, it was a huge audience. And they gave him a bracha. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Shechalak Mechachmaso Lireyav. A bracha that is reserved for great rabbinic scholars and great rabbanim alike. who made up the crowd of people that welcomed Rav Yaakov Yosef? This is very important. Most of them were Eastern European Jews who felt that his arrival marked the beginning of a Jewish revival in America, and there was almost universal euphoria about the potential of what his arrival would mean for Jews. And yet, despite the fact that so many were happy, as always in Judaism, we have two Jews and three opinions. And almost immediately people start wondering, it's very nice that we hired this rabbi, but what is he going to do? Right? What's the rabbi doing all day? How does he spend his time? I don't know, were there any golf courses on the Lower East Side of Manhattan at that day and age? I don't know, right? What was the rabbi doing? Let me share with you a quote from a Reform periodical called Jewish Tidings. And obviously, you have to read it the way it was, with a grain of salt. But nonetheless, I think it's important. He says, what do we need of an immigrant and prejudiced rabbi? Okay? He should go back to the land that gave, thank God, that gave him birth. Rabbi Joseph is unfamiliar with the language of this country and is therefore unfitted to exercise authority or influence over American Jews. The Jews of this country do not need a grand rabbi and one from a foreign country, one who is reared amongst the prejudices and bigotries of Eastern countries, will certainly prove an obstacle to the people over whom he is expected to exercise control. Don't forget, America was supposed to be a new opportunity. America was supposed to be a break from the old nature of Europe, where Jews were meek, and where Jews were in a ghetto, and where Jews looked different, and all of a sudden you were supposed to come to America, and it was the start of a new destiny. And here, you're going to bring us a rabbi who looks like them, and is going to ghettoize us just like they did over in Europe? That's not the type of person that we want. Dr. Sabato Moraes, who was the president of the Reform Seminary at the time, told a reporter for the New York Herald, quote, I never before heard of Rabbi Joseph. I am familiar with the manner in which the Hebrews in the place where he came are educated, and I know he is not a cultured man. He does not possess the knowledge nor the literary attainments which a rabbi in America should possess. Right? In other words, we're in a new environment. You have to look different and speak in a different way. And just because we imported someone over from Europe doesn't necessarily mean that he is the best person for the job. Nonetheless, despite all of this, Rabbi Joseph is offered a contract. How much is his contract for? The contract is for, I think it's about $2,800, $2,500 a year, right? Now, just to show you, that was a fantastic sum of money. The average rabbi in America at that day and age was making how much per year? $400 for a year, okay? And here, Rabbi Joseph is being given either $2,500 or $2,800 a year. Many people were very upset, as I said here, why is the rabbi driving such a nice car? And they felt, why is it that this rabbi, who's a foreigner, doesn't speak our language, doesn't look like us, act like us, or speak like us, is all of a sudden making more money than I am in the people that are paying his salary? No comment. Next. Here's the contract. Here's a copy, the verbiage of the contract that I want to share with you. We're going to read it a little bit together because I think it's very interesting. He says, we, the representatives of the congregation, united as the Association of the American Hebrew Orthodox Congregations, that was the name of the umbrella organization, unanimously decided at a meeting, 10th of Av, to invite as our guide and rabbi the great Gaon and complete sage, the pride of Judaism, world-renowned for his keen-minded knowledge of the whole Torah, the Honorable Rabbi Jacob Joseph. May Hashem guard him and keep him in his life. We'll see, those words are didn't come to fruition. To serve as chief rabbi for the congregations already united and those which will yet come under our banner. To teach us and to judge us in all matters pertaining to the law of Torah. To show us the road to follow and the things to do. To his voice shall we give heed. And from his word we shall not depart, either to the right or to the left in every matter touching upon our faith. We have obligated ourselves to pay the chief rabbi $3,000 a year, and also to provide a fine dwelling place and furnishings, which are to cost no less than $1,000 a year. His will also be an income from weddings, circumcisions, holiday gifts, and the like. In other words, that's just the base of the salary. Okay? Excluded, this is very important. Excluded as sources of income are divorces, heksherim, and licensing of shochtim, from which it is herewith stipulated that he may not derive any income. So he can't make money from that. But these will be under the supervision of the association as far as their fees are concerned. In other words, it doesn't mean that it's free. What does it mean? Who gets the money? The association gets the money, right? The OU gets the money, exactly. The OU gets the money. Okay, and again, that was not very popular, as we'll see in a second. Yaakov Yosef arrives and he delivers his first shop, his first drasha, Shabbos Nachamu. Beis Medrash HaGadol is packed beyond capacity. They decide not to do it as part of morning services because they don't want to detract. They want more people to be able to come. And so like almost like Shabbos Shuvah, Shabbos HaGadol drasha, they have it at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. There was enormous excitement. Drasha was 45 minutes long. No one ever complained about the lengths of mine or Rabbi Goldberg's drushas ever again. And it was largely acclaimed. Now, what you have in front of you on page number one, I expect everyone to be able to read. Now here's the good news. Even I can't read it. But here's what I will do. I'll try to read a little bit of it to you. So here we go. Because this is priceless. Okay? Here. Thronging Rabbi Joseph. That's the title. This is the New York Sun. I don't know what that is. Apparently it was a newspaper back then. New York Sun? Okay, you can get the archives online, thank God. So they had an article on July 22nd, 1888, which is this, I think, the Monday after his drasha. Okay? And it says the following. Okay? What was this blocking? I'm sorry. It says, a multitude press to hear the chief teacher's sermon. And here we go. Chief Rabbi Jacob Joseph, the learned Orthodox instructor who was brought to New York from Vilna, Poland, to expound the Mosaic laws for the Orthodox Jews of the East Side, made his first formal appearance yesterday at the synagogue of Beis Medrash HaGadol at 54 Norfolk Street. It was a notable event, and great was the crush. In other words, packed to the gills. Hey, by the way, I only photocopied it to you to look impressive, but I didn't actually think anyone would read it.
Did you do it in English?
What?
Russia, did you do it in English?
I do not know. No. I can't imagine. It must have been Yiddish. It must have been Yiddish. Ever since... Yeah, no, it's in Yiddish, because any versions I saw was translated. Ever since Rabbi Joseph's arrival in New York, the Orthodox of his race have been full of excitement and interest. From dawn until late at night, they have gathered about his house at 179 Henry Street, or when driven away by the police, have collected in groups on the opposite corner. Now, I don't know if this is actually true. Right? If it is, God bless it. I mean, but certainly that was the narrative that they were trying to project, was one of people just like drooling and salivating all over him. The rabbi's doorbell has been going constantly, and several of the leaders of the congregation have been continually in his house to prevent his being overrun by persons who had no special business except their enthusiasm to call them there. All the rabbi's movements were closely watched, and the announcement that he would appear in public yesterday threw the eager Hebrews into still greater commotion. The rabbi had determined not to preach in the usual manner at the morning services, but said he would deliver a lecture, partly in the nature of a sermon, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The trustees of the synagogue repaired to it early and made certain that everything was in proper condition. The scrolls containing the law were safe within the ark, and the light over the ark, which is never allowed to go out, was burning brightly. It's poetic, right? This is a New York Sun article, okay? It had been arranged not to admit any person not entitled to a seat. In other words, they must have had membership or, you know, had delineated who could sit where. It was known that there would be a crush, and as a synagogue is not large, it was necessary to prevent too much crowding. A committee was formed, and that's how they decide. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the arrangements had been completed But when the committee left the synagogue to take its place at the gate, it found a crowd gathered outside that entirely filled the street, as far down as Grand Street. The sidewalk was packed, so that it was next to impossible to force one's way through. By the way, I want to meet this rabbi, right? I mean, can you imagine if we did this Rabbi Goldberg on Shabbat Shuv and Shabbat Zagato? We should do that. We should start meeting him at his house and escorting him to shul, right? The crowd was composed of the same eager, enthusiastic Hebrews who had been hanging about the rabbi's house waiting for a glimpse of him. The trustees, knowing their excitable nature, feared that there might be trouble when the rabbi came over from his house and the desire of each one to get close to him. President Johns of the congregation of Beis Medrash HaGadol, trustee this, those in keep pushing forward, however, the committee saw that some more serious measure would have to be adopted. Word was sent to Police Captain Webb, and he sent back 6 policemen. They charged the crowd, pulled their clubs, but they were only 6 against a multitude and fought a losing battle. This is amazing, by the way. I mean, this is like really priceless stuff. The crowd yielded there, but returned as soon as the charge was over. A second notice was brought to the Delancey Street Station, and four more policemen were hurried over. Again, there were bruises, right? A number of heads were cracked, and bruises were something distributed. In other words, yeah, basically anti-Semitism. 6 arrests were made, Rabbi Joseph had remained entirely unaware of all this commotion. A committee of leading Hebrews arrived at his house at 3:30 and found him ready. It being Saturday, riding was out of the question, Okay, now they describe him. Rabbi Joseph is a medium stature and has a coal black beard which he wears long and divided in the middle. His eyes are black and piercing. At Grand and Norfolk Streets, the police under Captain Webb again drove back the crowd and escorted the rabbi safely into the synagogue. The latter was already crowded. The leading members, the different congregations, standing on the very steps of the platform. Again, a lot of excitement. The rabbi's voice is not powerful, and it is hard to catch the words at any distance. When he began to speak, therefore, everyone pushed forward. And while in the front part of the house, men were packed like sardines, all the rear pews were empty, right? And as we announce, there are seats up front. If you can't hear, come up front. In the gallery, a number of the men sat like Turks in front of the railing. I don't know what insinuation that is. While others leaned over from. Many stooped over, constraints they tried to hear. Okay. The services began with prayer, reading. Then Rabbi Joseph, throwing over his shoulders a wide white scarf with black stripes, right? Talis, ascended the platform and began. He spoke slowly and deliberately, frequently pausing to find a word or a sentence. His quotations were in classic Hebrew, but his general discourse was in the jargon of mixed Polish, German, and Hebrew. He said, this, I'll read it to you inside later, but he said the following. We're not going to read this whole thing, okay? He basically says the following. We have to make a Kiddush Hashem, right? I mean, that's the nutshell, okay? He says, the spiritual greatness of Abraham, according to the teachings of our rabbis, consisted in converting men to religious truth. But how did Avram succeed in converting his neighbors? What he argued with the rude, unequivocal people of his time? Right? No, did he fight with them? Neither argument can seldom avail with idolaters. Such sinners are either sharp enough to understand the folly of their religious something. In other words, you're not going to argue with them. So what did he do? Instead, historically, we have experienced the truth of this suggestion. What was his suggestion here? His suggestion is that you have to love them. You have to be basically such a good person that they are going to want to be like you. Father Abraham did not argue and philosophize with his neighbors. He simply followed the commandments of God the best that he knew. In other words, he lived an honest, authentic, dignified Jewish lifestyle. Something his success in converting others to faith was due to something else. A precious jewel, our rabbis say, allegorically hung on his breast of Abraham. And every invalid who looked at it was cured. He says it doesn't mean that he actually wore something. It means that he lived such a moral lifestyle that those who saw him wanted to be a better person, right? From which moral culture to the appreciation of religious truth is but one step. Such a leader was the progenitor of our race, and therefore, at his demise, our sages say the dirges were sung, woe unto the vessel that lost his rudder. In other words, he makes an appeal to American Jewry that what? We're not going to argue with people. We're not going to fight with people. We're not going to philosophize with people. But what are we going to do? We're going to inspire them. We're going to lead by example. We're going to become the best versions of what Avram wants us to become. And we're going to therefore show people that they're going to want to be more like us. We're not going to be on the front pages of the New York Post, the New York Sun for, you know, going to jail and for tax evasions, right? That's not what's going to inspire people. But living a righteous, religious, dignified lifestyle, that is ultimately what is going to inspire people. Like anything, what starts off with enormous amount of excitement quickly spirals into lots of problems and lots of pitfalls. Number one is the following announcement from the chief rabbi, where he essentially says that from now on, any meat that's going to be kosher is going to have my seal. Okay? And if it doesn't, then it's not kosher. Oh, and by the way, if you want my kosher seal, guess what? It's going to cost you a lot of money. Everyone was unhappy. First of all, everyone is unhappy. Number one, many people saw this as a source of income, that the chief rabbi was against charging from it, and yet he said in his own writings that he had to surrender to the superior wisdom of, quote, the American businessmen who had brought him to the country. In other words, he did not want to mix money with the rabbinate. And the people who brought him to the country said, we need to make back the money that we shelled out for you, and we're going to do it through kashrus. And so Rav Yaakov Yosef gives in. They reach a compromise, and that is to only tax poultry and not meat. Meat was apparently for the everyday man. Poultry was considered much more for the rich people. I'll take their word for it. But that was the compromise that was reached between Rav Yaakov Yosef and his board. Everyone was furious. Housewives were furious because they had an extra charge for money. Butchers resented it because they lost control. Other rabbis resented it because what did they lose? They lost their income. And most everyone viewed it as no different than what the Russians were doing. The Russians apparently were taxing the Jews on meat. It was called a korobka. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. Okay, and it was a big deal in Russia. Many people felt that it was a violation of the religious liberties of the Jewish community by having their meat taxed. And so they saw what Rav Yaakov Yosef was doing in America no different than what the Russian government was doing in Russia. A poem was written, and I think it is a very telling poem. Dance, Orthodox chickens, make merry, have no fear. For the rabbi an order has issued, shiny lead medals you'll wear. You'll wear them after your slaughter, that the chief rabbi may live. In other words, whose salary are you paying? They flay the skin off the worker, a fat scary the great one to give. Okay, in other words, it's obviously a joke about, like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's a, what was it?
Parody.
A parody, thank you. A parody against Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. People started questioning his authority. After all, who died and made him the chief rabbi of New York? Right? Did every single Jew in New York get together and vote on his candidacy? Was every congregation in New York participating in bringing him over? Who decides who becomes the chief rabbi? There was no formal election process. And so many started saying, this isn't fair. Who brought this guy in and decided that he was going to be the chief rabbi? I'll share with you some quotes. This all hit a head, Pesach, when Rabbi Yosef decided that there wouldn't only be a tax on chicken and meat, but there would be a $1 tax on every barrel of Pesach flour. Okay? And people went crazy. Even his fiercest defenders were starting to waver. This is from the periodical American Hebrew, wrote the following. From the very first announcement of the fact that it was intended to secure a chief rabbi, we were extremely interested in the project. In other words, we like this idea. We trust that its further usefulness will not be hampered, as there seems danger of its being hindered by the officious intervention of men who would like to enact the role of power behind the throne. In other words, they're not blaming Rabbi Yosef. They're saying his board are a bunch of egomaniacs who are trying to grab power and make money for themselves. All the good results of this of his beneficent influence can be blighted by using him as a tool for monetary ends. The United Orthodox congregations must seek other means of supporting the organization they maintain, rather than by using the Grand Rabbi's name as a means of extracting money. Right? In other words, don't use the rabbi. Right? You can't mix the two. Here's a different headline. The first and greatest mistake was to use him as a source of revenue. This was a profanation, a sacrilege, such a shameless outrage as bringing here a learned man to act as grand rabbi and then setting him to collecting money for them. Okay? They are bastardizing the position of the chief rabbi of America, of New York. And so what some congregations did, many Hungarian, Galician congregations got together, and they said, you are not my chief rabbi. And they started considering someone of their own. And they actually elected 20 congregations, Rabbi Yoshua Siegel, Rabbi Joshua Siegel, known as the Sherp Sarav, and they declare him to be their own chief rabbi. Okay. Many congregations start skipping payments. They draw support altogether. In 1895, the butchers get together and they unite in rejecting Rabbi Yosef's authority, essentially leaving him with absolutely nothing. From 1895 to 1902, he becomes quite ill. He becomes bedridden. The community that had been there to support him and that was there to promote him instead completely neglected him. And he dies in 1902. To add insult to injury. The men who were supposed to financially support him and the men that abandoned him and left him to die, they profit off of his death. They go to his widow and they say, we have a deal for you. We'll pay you to have Rabbi Yosef buried in our cemetery. Now, why? Why? Anyone ever been to the Lubavitcher Rebbe's OL? Right? Now, how many people would go to that cemetery if the Lubavitcher Rebbe were not buried there? Not as many. Right? In other words, there's a currency that comes with great gedolim being in a certain cemetery. It gives a chashivas. And therefore, if a great gadol is buried in that cemetery, what can you do to the other plots? You could charge a lot more money. And so, cemeteries were bidding against each other to have Rabbi Yosef buried in their cemetery. And his funeral was delayed as a result. It's ultimate chutzpah. These people were there to support him and now they're profiting off his death. Ultimately, his widow received $1,500 to have him buried in that specific cemetery and $15 a year in perpetuity for the rest of her life. That was the bone that they threw to her at the end of the process. Okay, here you see the obituary in the New York Times, the death of Chief Rabbi Jacob Joseph, highest official in Orthodox Jewish religion in America, prayers in the street after the announcement. Chief Rabbi Joseph, United Jewish congregations, the highest official, died at 11:45 last night in his home. Rabbi Joseph was 62 years old. He had been for 14 years in the city at the head of Congregation Beis Medrash HaGadol, He was attended by his son-in-law, As soon as his death became known, crowds began to gather in front of the house. Nearly 1,000 persons were there, and prayers were offered for the rabbi. The fervor of the men and women was striking. Inside the house could be heard loud lamentations over his death. His burial. These are pictures from the burial. You have on top the attack taking place, again from R.H. Ho and company, where they bombarded the mourners with stones and metals. The police, confused, using air quotations, the rioters with the victims, and many Jews were clubbed. You have on the bottom, the horse and buggies are actually ambulances, right? You have on top there, that's H.O. That's what's it called? That's the R.H.O. and company on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And here you have a picture of what the funeral looked like. And what do you notice immediately? Lots and lots of people. Lots and lots of people. Okay? And so I end where we began. Here you have an individual brought over from Europe. And the questions linger, and you can answer them for yourselves at this point. Right? Was America hospitable to a chief rabbi? The answer is America was very different than Great Britain. America as an immigrant community meant that there were lots of different people with lots of different perspectives and lots of different traditions, and they weren't necessarily interested in one chief rabbi. Could an imported European rabbi succeed in America? It's very difficult, right? You have to know how to maneuver and manipulate things politically. You have to have that certain skill set. Could different Jews unite? Again, we saw that that was oftentimes not the case. The story of Rav Yaakov Yosef is the story of a first attempt to bring a chief rabbi to New York, to these shores. And ultimately, when you look back on his life, what is one word that jumps out in your mind? To me, it was tragic. Tragic life. Someone who had enormous potential, who was revered, who was brought over with great acclaim, and yet simply got mirrored in the politics of America. Got mirrored in the politics of kashrus and money, was clearly manipulated and used by people who were seeking that money and seeking the ego that was behind it, and someone who didn't know how to manipulate things politically enough to protect himself. Rabbi Yosef had a very famous great-grandson, namesake, and that is 22-year-old USMC Captain Jacob Joseph. He was killed in the Battle of Guadalcanal in the Pacific Theater in 1942, 77 years ago. To this day, on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, there's the Captain Jacob Joseph Playground. To me, this is obviously enormously tragic, right? But it's also the fulfillment. Many people would look at this with pride and say, what a great testament to who Rabbi Yosef was, that his great-grandson served in what? The American Army. And many people would look at that and say, that's the success of immigration to America. Others would probably disagree. And lastly, the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School. Show your banner. Come on. There you go. Anyone else a graduate? Back there? Okay. Oh, we got a couple graduates here. It was founded in 1903 by his son, Raphael and Samuel Andron. Of course, it was originally located in the Lower East Side, then moved to Staten Island. It has produced the RJJ Journal, the Journal of Halach and Contemporary Society, a very prestigious religious halachic journal. And I left off the list some of the people in this room. The notable alumni, Meir Zlotowitz, Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Weinreb, Sheldon Silver, Rabbi Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg, and Robert Aumann, of course, the Nobel Prize winner. But the school really had nothing to do with him. It was an effort by his son after his death. What?
Shimi's father, Rabbi.
Shimi's father. Well, I didn't want to spoil that. Okay, yeah.
I just wanted to add that at his funeral, when they threw down the stones, and it was the screwdriver company, they turned over his casket, and it fell down on the ground. And that was the bizayon.
That was the bizayon.
And also,
well, the whole thing was a bizayon.
This man's father or son, there was a man, Lazarus Joseph, who was the controller of the city of New York for about 12 years.
Really? Okay, great, thank you. Anyways, hopefully tonight, I'll take more questions afterwards, hopefully tonight gave you a greater insight into not just who Rav Yaakov Yosef was, but ultimately into the complexity that was American Jewry at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries. the challenges that they faced, the politics that exhibited, and really you saw the yearning from some Jews for more spirituality, for more Judaism, and others who wanted it done on their own term. Everyone have a wonderful week.